All right, this is the magical hour, the interactive hour, where we take your phone calls. Seth Shostak with us from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And welcome back, Seth Shostak with us from SETI, the Institute. What's new with SETI these days, Seth? What projects are you folks working on?
Well, one thing that we're doing is putting a project on the Very Large Array, which decorates part of the New Mexico desert. People have seen the Very Large Array, even if they haven't visited it, and you can visit it, by the way. It's about an hour or so from Albuquerque. You could have seen it in the movie Contact and in other films.
Mm-hmm,
as well.
I sure did.
Yeah. 27 antennas, and the idea there is to essentially put in some equipment so that when the VLA, as it's called, the Very Large Array, is being used for, you know, astronomy, you can also take a feed off of it and look at those data, look at that cosmic static, if you will, and see if there are any signals from, extraterrestrials in it. So it's a way to get a lot of telescope time without having to build a big telescope.
Well, and let me ask you this too, Seth, that before the Paul Allen Array of telescopes, what did you have?
Well, we were using an existing radio telescope. So we went to Arecibo, you know that, down in Puerto Rico.
Right.
Because we talked from
there.
But
you were at their mercy, right?
Well, you're at their mercy. I mean, the real problem is a big antenna like that is being used by many, many people for astronomy. I've used it myself for studying galaxies. Because it's a big antenna. It's really, really interesting piece of equipment for doing astronomy. So you're competing with all the people who want to use it to study, you know, pulsars or small galaxies or whatever. And it's like, you know, here's a big research facility to develop new techniques in medicine or something, or new cures, and there's only one microscope, and everybody wants to use it, so you have to schedule it.
I still get that handful of emails once in a while, Seth, from folks who say, the government will never allow SETI to tell us what they find.
Yeah, well, I think I said before.
I think you'd be on the show that night.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, I just wish the government had that much interest in what we were doing to want to, you know, keep it quiet. But as I've said before, I mean, there's just no way to keep it quiet. I mean, the first thing you're going to do if you get a signal that looks really good is you're going to call somebody up at another observatory and say, hey, you guys, sorry to bug you, but
verify this thing.
Yeah, verify this, and they'll call somebody else, and pretty soon there would be people all around the world who would know about it, and that would all happen within a day or two.
Is it conceivable you could pick up a signal from this planet, somehow it leaks over or something like that?
Well, you can easily pick up something from this planet. We do it all the time, but, you know, those are, you know, that's probably not what you're talking about. Those are just, you know, satellites. There's thousands
right.
of satellites up there, and they have transmitters, the ones that are working, and you pick those up. But I think you're talking about picking up a signal that somehow bounced off something out in space.
That's right.
And
comes back to us.
Yeah, that's hard to do. I mean, if you have a big radar set, you can bounce something off the moon and pick it up the reflection. People have certainly done that. And in the early days, before you had really good rockets that could carry probes to other planets, you know, they would study Venus and some other. That was going to be my thesis, actually, to use radar to study Venus, because it's covered with clouds, but the radar goes right through the clouds. So you aim the radar at Venus, and some of that energy comes back. Today, some of the people at the SETI Institute actually map asteroids and so forth. You know, they have these kind of nifty little models sitting on their desk of asteroids they've mapped with radar. So in that case, yes, you can get something back. But if you aim a radar set at some other star system, hoping there's a planet there, and there probably is, you're not going to get enough energy coming back to measure to see it. It's very hard.
Let's go to Thomas in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, on the wild card line to get us started. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Hey, guys.
Good to
How's
have
going,
you with
George?
Us. Good. Thank you.
I have a question. Maybe your guest could shed some light on these things.
Okay.
The famous discovery of Mars, the pyramid, and the Sphinx as well, and if he has time, the starter symbol.
How about the face on Mars, the pyramids, any tie-in there? What do you think of all those? Seth?
Yeah, well, that's kind of an old story. That's from the time when the Viking landers, I mean, that was the 1970s, actually, that Tom's talking about, when they first came back with a picture of Mars that was good enough that you could see mountains, and there was one that NASA thought, well, this will amuse the public, and they put out this photo, and they say, hey, look, there's a face there. And the idea, Tom, was not that there was really a face there any more than, you know, when you look at a grilled cheese sandwich, you sometimes see a face too, but it's perfectly natural. And the face on Mars, even though there's been a lot of talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We've got a guest named George Haas from the Cydonia Institute.
Really?
Who claims that now he has seen a large structure, but he calls it the raptor. It looks like a bird's head.
Well,
it's weird. I got to tell you, I've looked at it, and it's strange.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these stories are going to go away as we have more and more rovers on Mars, and then eventually people. I mean, you know, Elon Musk wants to send people to Mars in very short order. And, you know, they might go visit some of these places and take pictures on the ground. But I don't think that the face on Mars or, you know, birds on Mars, I mean, that's, you know, that's just your brain turning, you know, rocks into something that looks familiar.
Boy, did I get UFO calls when Elon Musk's first Starlink project was launched.
Yeah.
And you had like those 30 to 40 satellites back to back, back to back. And you could see them like little beads going across the sky. And people were calling Seth like crazy.
Yeah, well, I hope there were. I hope some astronomers called Elon. In fact, I'm sure they did, and tell him that, you know, this could make it tough for astronomers on the Earth because you got all these bright lights going overhead, you know, at sunset and sunrise and so forth. So, yeah, that's a problem for the astronomers. But I think that the people like Elon Musk and some others who are putting up these sort of you know, big phalanxes of satellites. They at least agree to paint them black or something like that. That helps.
Next up, Carol in Connecticut. Welcome to the program. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Dr. Norrie and guest. Yes, concerning the bigger picture of our solar system, maybe you can comment about, you know, that I had heard that between 1 billion and 2 billion years can go by, that our solar system works its way in and out of every spiral arm of the Milky Way galaxy. And during that time, there's this, like, astral plane that it goes above and below, where we're exposed to, like, tremendous radiation from the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And this is what may cause our, like, our tremendous ice ages, four or six ice ages that we've had. And I guess this concerns major and minor changes with our solar system.
Put your astronomy hat on, Seth. What do you think?
I got it right here. Well, Carol, that's an interesting comment there. And it is true. I mean, what Carol says, our own solar system is sort of going up and down and up and down as it goes around the Milky Way. We're going around the Milky Way like all the other stars you can see. You know, it's a big galaxy. And it takes us about 250 million years to go around once. So, you know, you'll be back here, but you have to wait 250 million years. But it isn't just in a flat, you know, it isn't like horses in a carousel. Those horses, yeah, they, well, actually, it is like the horses there because they do go up and down, right? You know, they would give the kids a little more fun. And our solar system does the same. Now, what Carol is suggesting is that when it goes up and it's out of the, if you will, the central plane of the galaxy, it's above this big disk of stars a little bit, and that happens, that, you know, suddenly we're going to be exposed to deadly radiation from the center of the galaxy. But, you know, I don't think it's a very big effect. The only effect that might be important is sometimes when you go up and down, you might come through a big dust cloud,
mm-hmm.
right? And that might dim the sun a little bit, and a dim sun might be, you know, good at your local Chinese restaurant, but a dim sun might do some damage to you. But I would suggest to Carol not to worry about this.
Do you believe, Seth, as some people think, that when you go through a black hole, you go into another universe?
Well, I mean, you know.
Who knows?
Yeah, well, I think nobody knows for sure. I've asked some people who work on black holes that very question. I said, you know, could somebody use a big black hole? Because you would go through a usual run-of-the-mill, off-the-shelf
I mean, it does go into something, doesn't it?
Well, mostly you just go into the black hole, which is too bad because then you're gone. But if it's a big black hole, right, and there are big black holes, if it's a big black hole, then you don't get ripped up when you go in. And if you just don't aim for the center, you know, you just sort of go in kind of cattywampus into that big black hole, you know, some of the equations seem to suggest that you might indeed go into another universe. But I asked a fellow I knew working on this. I said, you know, do you think that works? Could somebody come visit us from another universe or another part of our universe? And he said, well, that would result in a situation where you're sitting there and somebody pops up next to you from another universe. And he said that would be so unpleasant that he doesn't think it actually could happen.
Let's go to Denver. Mike is with us. Hello there, Mr. Millennial. Good to have you with us.
Hey, good morning, George. Thank you so much for taking my call. And Seth, wow, it is such an honor to talk with you. I can cross this off my bucket list. I always look forward to you being on the program, and it's such an honor to speak with you, and I want to thank you for all your work so much. I had a comment and a question tonight. So, you know, when we talk about Goldilocks zones, of the 1,780 confirmed planets beyond our solar system, as many as 16 of them are located in their star's habitable zone, where conditions are neither too hot nor too cold to support life. And, you know, they've found planets in these habitable zones, these Goldilocks zones, that, you know, theoretically could support life. And I just think it's really interesting when we look at these habitable zones, the life that could be there. So, you know, my question is, what kind of extraterrestrial life, if any, do you think could possibly exist in these Goldilocks zones? Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's terrific, Mike. It's true. We found a lot of planets. I mean, I think the total is over 4,000, I think. And most of them were found by, you know, the NASA's Kepler Space Telescope. But, you know, essentially every week you find more planets. The really interesting thing, of course, is not that we're finding all these thousands of planets. It's finding that almost every star has planets. You know, so you don't have to find them all. You just know that when you look up in the sky and you see the stars there, most of them have planets. And it's probably not quite true, because most of the stars you see with your naked eye are not the right kind of stars. But never mind that. That's a technicality. Mike was asking about the Goldilocks zone.
That perfect spot to be in, right?
Yeah, good spot to be in. It's, you know, it's somewhere between, I don't know, Denver and Nederland.
That's right. Or where we are with our sun.
Yes. We're at the place where it's not too hot, not too cold, so you can have liquid oceans, you could have a nice atmosphere, all that good stuff. But point out to Mike something he probably already knows. You know, one place we might find life is one of the moons of Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
And, George, you've already mentioned, you know, Europa around Jupiter.
Yep.
Could be life there. I mean,
what about Titan up there at Saturn?
Titan might have, yeah, Titan's an interesting place. It would be life at low temperature, but maybe.
Yeah.
And you know, there's seven places in our solar system where there might be life. And the majority of them are not in what you might call the Goldilocks zone. So it turns out that the Goldilocks is great, but some other bears might actually have some life, too.
You once said something to me, Seth, about 17, 18 years ago that I never forgot. And you said the primordial soup in the universe is everywhere. And to me, that meant that the elements, the complexity, it's all the same.
Yeah.
Out there.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, that's one of the great triumphs of astronomy in the last century, is, you know, to prove that the same elements that you had to learn in 11th grade are on, you know, they're in all the stars and all the planets that are out there. Everything's made of the same stuff. And the big advantage there is that if you move to another solar system, if that's, you know, do it for tax purposes or whatever, you move to another solar system, you don't have to take chemistry again. It's going to be the same. Physics will be the same.
That's right.
So if it works here, it might work there. It's kind of the bottom line.
And if there is intelligent life out there, wouldn't it generally look like us?
Well, George, I just had to give a talk about that two nights ago, or maybe it was only, you know, two nights ago, whatever. And, you know, it is true that, you know, we're kind of nicely engineered from the standpoint of survival as an intelligent species. We've got heads. Heads are useful.
We have arms. We have thumbs.
Opposable thumbs. We've got two eyes for stereo vision. We've got pretty good ears. Now, we're not great on smell.
I mean, who would make a mouth to eat? I mean, that's genius.
Well, if you don't do it, you know, you have other problems. But all you have to do is go to the zoo and look at all the other designs that work here on Earth. And you realize, well, humans are one design that works, but it's not the only one. So the aliens might not have two arms and two legs. That's an artifact. That's just a consequence of the fish we evolved from. You know, they might have four legs and two arms, or two legs and four arms.
Maybe two heads. Who knows?
Yeah, you don't know. But one thing you can say, they won't be very, very much bigger or very much smaller for some good engineering reason. So you know, you would recognize it as something you might invite over for dinner.
They say had the dinosaurs not died out, we wouldn't be here. Will you agree with that?
Well, that seems to be true. I mean, the dinosaurs were very successful in, you know, in a biological sense. I mean, they were doing just fine.
They ran the planet.
They did. And, you know, you can argue that they ran it better than we do. But, you know, there wasn't really so much evolutionary pressure for dinos to get smarter. I mean, if they could, you know, find something to eat every day and reproduce, good enough. You know, brains are very expensive in terms of the calories you burn. So it's not clear. I mean, the dinosaurs were around for 150 million years. They didn't get very smart. So it's unclear that if that rock hadn't kind of wiped them out, that we wouldn't just have dinosaurs everywhere today.
Let's go to Brian in Crestline, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Good to talk to you again.
You
too.
I was
the camera guy out at the Unexplained in Burbank.
That's right. Absolutely. You did a great job for us.
Well, if it was maybe greater, it probably would still be on. But anyway, it was a lot of fun. And enjoyed that. Hey, it's always great when you have Seth on. So, Seth, my question to you is, for several years I worked in the optics industry. Of course, that's nanometer wave stuff. And there were a couple of tools in my tool shed I would use to look for anomalies. One of them was polarization, you know, looking for birefringence. And another far more useful tool, was interferometry for looking for things that you couldn't see. Now you spoke of this new array in New Mexico that you're in charge of talking about. Now I might be way behind the eight ball on you. This may be a silly question, but it occurred to me. I mean, you're working in millimeter wavelengths, and it's a similar nature to nanometer wavelengths. Do you guys have you considered or do you utilize interferometry and looking for these minute signals that may not be aimed at us, looking for anomalies out there at a few hundred to a few thousand light years?
Yeah, well, Brian, to begin with, I wish I had your voice. But secondly, the very large array is indeed designed to be an interferometer. That's why there are 27 antennas there. And they're on railroad tracks, so they can move them around. You know, you look at a galaxy with one set of spacings of all these antennas, and you power them over to another location and do it again. And, you know, it's just, as you say, it's just interferometry to make, if you will, pictures of the sky in radio wavelengths. Okay, so they're radio pictures. Now, would that help with SETI? No, I don't think so, because you're not trying to make a picture of ET's antenna farm. You just want to pick up the signal, so all you care about is sensitivity. But if you're a radio astronomer studying galaxies or nebulae of any kind, you want to make pictures, and that's why they use interferometry, and you would know about it. By the way, it's not at millimeter wavelengths. Those are other antennas, but it's mostly centimeter wave stuff.
Are the arrays constantly looking and listening by shifting?
These big radio telescopes are like any kind of telescopes. And we're talking radio telescopes, but, you know, they're big optical telescopes, giant mirrors and so forth, sitting in Chile and, of course, on Mauna Kea in Hawaii. I mean, it's really interesting to go visit these things, and you can. And, they're trying to build a telescope whose mirror is 30 meters in diameter.
Wow, that would be great. Seth, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Jerry Corsi is going to join us for a couple hours talking about all things that are going on this planet. So we're going to talk about COVID-19, the Middle Eastern situation, this what could be screwed up presidential election. We'll be talking with Jerry about that. Then our investigative reporter, Cheryl Jones, joins us for a couple hours, followed by Conversations with Cheryl, where we'll take your phone calls. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our final segment with Seth Shostak from SETI and your calls. Seth, how did you get recruited by SETI? How did that happen?
Well, yeah, it was because I went to a party in Berkeley, California. When I came back to California, I was living in Europe, and I came back here working with my brother, actually, one of my brothers on a software startup, and I went to a party in Berkeley, and somebody there told people at the SETI Institute that, oh, gosh, guess what? Seth is back in the U.S., And after that, I got a phone call, and they said, you know, would you like a job here? That was back when there was NASA money to pay for my
That's right.
There.
Exactly. Did you fall in love with it the first time you got there?
Well, the SETI Institute, sure.
Yeah.
It's hard not to. I mean, it's just a nice place to work.
How many employees do you have there?
Well, the number of scientists is on the order of 100. And then, of course, there's support people, you know, and the CEO and stuff like that. Now, mind you, the number of people that are doing SETI research is actually fairly small. And that's a money thing because the other people working there, the scientists there, are financed by grant monies. In other words, they write a proposal to, say, NASA, and they want to study something about Mars, and they're going to spend this amount of money over that amount of time. And if they get that grant, then they get a desk.
Are they independent, or does this money flow through SETI then to them?
Well, it flows through SETI to them. And so what it means is, yeah, you get a desk, but some of your grant money goes to the Institute and not to your bank account.
Uh-huh.
To pay for your office and the
secretarial help and all that stuff.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's fascinating. And are these scientists all working on different projects?
Pretty much. Yeah, most of them are working as individuals or maybe little groups of two or three. They might have a student or two. But most people are doing their own thing. And it's, that's the way science works. You have a lot of people working on things, and many of them you might say, well, that doesn't sound like it's important. But what you learn if you do this long enough is that even things that don't seem important at the start can often turn out to be incredibly important. So that's the nature of basic research in science.
Let's go to Joe. Welcome to the program in Monterey. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George.
You are welcome.
Okay. When I was in the Navy, I looked up and I saw the Southern Cross. It's so beautiful. You're looking in a limited technological spectrum. These races had to find solutions to many of their challenges the way we do. We have different challenges in energy. We had to overcome a lot of different things. We didn't kill ourselves in nuclear war. Hopefully we won't. They also faced these different things, but they also faced the problem of keeping abreast or up to their technology, which means they had to change themselves. We are in the process of doing that now through genetic reengineering to meet the challenges of a technology that will move faster than we do. So they had to overcome those same challenges. They have a different genetics. They are interdimensional. We have two strands. They have three strands. They're interdimensional, and they have faced those similar challenges that we had, but they've gone beyond that. They don't need technology to communicate the way we do. They are telepathic. Most of them are. Some of them aren't. So,
let me just stop you there. It's certainly true what you say, that people on other planets have had other evolutionary histories. Maybe they didn't have dinosaurs, maybe they had something else. I mean, there's all that. But you also point out that there are various challenges that any society of intelligent beings is going to face, maybe developing technology for war that, is so dangerous they could wipe themselves out. I mean, there are all these sorts of things, and that's indisputable. But if you say their DNA is not, two twisted strands but three, then I have to ask you, how do you know that?
Well, if you develop your ability to communicate to them, and if you are in the area of, you do know that soul reincarnates. That's been proven by different people. And souls don't have to keep coming back to the same planet. They can come from other planets. Well, there are souls on this planet that are from different planets and even from different universe, and they come here. This is a learning area, and we do pretty good in learning and overcoming our challenges.
Well, you're obviously you're tuned into information that the rest of the world doesn't have, and all I can suggest to you is that, if true, this is very important, but you really ought to write it up and tell people how you know these things, what's the evidence, You got to show them the evidence. Otherwise, for a scientist, you know, you're telling me an interesting story, but I don't have to believe it if you don't have the evidence.
Any predictions, Seth, on other breakthroughs coming up in the future?
Well, of course, the whole nature of breakthroughs is you never see them coming. I think we're living in a good time for breakthroughs, though, because we are getting, you know, they're bigger instruments, bigger telescopes, not just the ones that they're trying to build in Hawaii and in Chile, but also radio telescopes. There's something called the square kilometer array, and that's been doing some interesting things. Some of that is in, you know, the outback of Australia, parts of Australia that you really don't want to visit for terribly long because it's so dry and terrible. But there are these new instruments coming on. Computers are getting better. The receivers are getting better. You know, with all this happening, the history of research tells you there are going to be very interesting things that get found. I mean, the universe seems to be pretty complicated, and it's interesting to find new things.
Was it SETI that did an experiment years ago tying a whole bunch of computers together?
I don't know if you're talking about SETI at home.
SETI at home, that was it.
Yeah.
Was that you?
I'm sorry, George.
Was that part of you?
No, it wasn't, but we do get the credit for it, which is...
You do, yeah.
Kind of sad. No, that was developed over at the University of California, Berkeley. They recently put SETI at home on the back burner. It's sort of in limbo for a while. And the reason is not that it didn't work. You know, everybody could download this screensaver, and when you leave your computer to go get yourself a sandwich or something, it would crunch away on some SETI data, which means that you at home might be the first to find ET. But it required, you know, people to pay attention. I mean, you had to have people that were managing this whole project.
Yeah, some savvy there.
Yeah, so it was expensive. It worked, but it was expensive.
Charlie in Tennessee, you're on with Seth. Go ahead, Charlie.
Hey, guys.
Hey there.
How you doing?
Good.
Seth, you are awesome.
I agree, Seth. You are.
The two of you and my mom, that's it.
And a nice guy, too.
Yes. George, you need to have this guy on very often.
He's a good guy.
You answered a lot of questions I was going to ask, but just a couple.
Sure.
Number one, Venus. Is Venus, does it not have sulfuric acid rain?
Yeah. Yeah, Charlie, you're absolutely right. We talked about Venus in the first hour. I don't know if you were tuned in then, but... And, you know, but that was the story of the phosphine and the possibility that, you know, up in the cooler parts of the atmosphere of Venus, up there in the clouds, there could be some microbes floating around. But your point is a good one, that there's also sulfuric acid there. And nobody wants to live in an atmosphere filled with sulfuric acid. You know,
No. Hard to breathe.
Yeah. But microbes are tough, Charlie. I mean, microbes on Earth are able to live in acid, actually, some of them anyhow. So it's not impossible that life's there.
Charlie, go ahead with your other question.
Yes, I've heard that some bacteria can actually live in acid.
Right.
But don't bacteria, they have to live on something, right?
Yeah, that's another good point. I mean, the question you're asking is, well, if those microbes, those bacteria there on Venus really are there, what do they eat? And because they're up in the air, what's there to eat? And it's, you know, it's a good question, but there are, if you will, what are called chemical pathways. There are chemical reactions that can happen in that atmosphere because there's a lot of stuff. I mean, it's, you know, it's not just carbon dioxide, but also that sulfuric acid you mentioned. And there are other compounds in the atmosphere there. So the bacteria have to have figured out a way to convert some of that some of that chemical stuff there into food for themselves. In other words, they have to have some reactions that provides them with energy. And that's right. I mean, Charlie, you're absolutely right. Sulfuric acid, no option food. It's tough.
It's like acid rain almost, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I don't know that it rains down, but, you know, there is a lot of sulfuric acid there. Look, In the end, the bottom line here is it's a really interesting idea, and it might be life. And what you really want to do is throw a spacecraft at Venus and have it fall through this area and, you know, sample the airs on its way down and radio back, yep, there are bacteria, or radio back, nope, there are no bacteria. That there are like a dozen proposals to do that, to, you know, send something to Venus again, but none of them has been green-lighted. In other words, none of them has been promised the money to do it, but I bet they will now.
Do planetary cores ever burn out, their magnetic cores?
Well, I don't know about burning out, but they probably, well, in a way, they sort of
They're rotating,
out.
Aren't they?
Yeah. You know, you have this iron and nickel in the center of the Earth that's rotating around relative to the Earth, and that's what produces this magnetic field. And, you know, it's going to stop at some point, and it often, you know, does things like change direction. And when it changes direction for a while, there's no magnetic field, and birds get confused or whatever. But, I mean, that's something that happens on the scale of hundreds of thousands of years, at least tens of thousands of years. And some planets don't have any magnetic field at all. I mean, Mars doesn't have much of a magnetic field, in fact.
Let's go to Ginny in Alaska, first-time caller. Hi, Ginny, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, great. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, sir.
And you're
so Seth
is here. Ask him a question.
Yeah, so I obviously called earlier and let you know about some alien stuff that I saw.
Well,
UFOs.
Tell us what it was, Jenny.
Well, above the elementary school and...
It's Elmendorf.
Elmendorf, we went down from
Lanary
Park, and all of a sudden we were laying there, and I'm like, fine, I'll go. And it's cold, you know, I'm like, God, this sucks. Like, you want to go in a park? Like, come on. You want a picnic? It's cold. And it's like, yeah. So we went there, and then we were laying on the beach, and then all of a sudden, next to Elmendorf, and then it was just crazy that the main airport were laying there, and it was
like a sound.
Who's on the air with us here, Jenny? I hear another voice.
Yeah, it's Dustin. Dustin likes to talk.
Hi, Dustin. Come on in.
My name's Dustin Darden. I'm here in
Ecuador. You like to talk for me.
Okay, so we're laying on the beach having a picnic, and I see what I thought was a satellite going across the sky, and then it was elongated, and then it started moving around.
Oh.
Early cue, and then there was two. Listen to this. And then I was like, Jenny, look at this. And she's like, Dustin, let's go. Let's get out of here. Let me finish it. Yeah, we'll get back to Jenny. And then there's three, and it's like an equilateral triangle, but they weren't lined up perfectly. But I was watching it move, and I could see the sequence, and it was an equilateral triangle.
Well, I got to tell you, satellites do not do that at all. Do they, Seth?
Nope.
No. So there's something else going on up there, that's for sure.
Yeah, there is. You know, what I would recommend to Ginny's friend there, I didn't get his name, you know, the next time you see this, pull out your phone or whatever and you make some photos. Make some videos. Videos are better than photos.
What do you think of the Navy videos?
Well, you know, I was just talking to a couple of guys a couple of weeks ago, actually, who are, you know, sort of academics. They're both in academia. But they also have both flown military planes. And so, you know, they had used the kind of radar imaging systems that were on those those Navy Hornet jets. So they had used the infrared cameras, they'd used the visible light cameras. They, you know, they had experience about this. And they were not terribly impressed with the Navy photos in the sense that they've seen similar stuff and they don't think that it was, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Well, let me give you a simple example. You know that, what are called the
Tic Tac version.
Yeah, the Tic Tac video. It looks like a peanut. Right?
It does.
And there's a black peanut. It's black only because it's infrared, and that's the way the instrument shows it to you. It's not necessarily black, but anyhow.
It's moving around.
It's moving around, and then it seems to sort of twist a little bit. And the twisting and so forth, these guys said, yeah, no, that could be the tracking of the camera. I don't know, but that's what they said. But the other thing that they said that I think makes sense is that the peanut itself could be that in front of the Navy jet, maybe a mile or two or something like that, there might be a twin-engine jet, a commercial aircraft, something else, And you're just looking down the tailpipes of that twin engine.
Yeah, that's fun, but they could not catch it. Seth, the clock's got us. I want to thank you for being on the program. As usual, you're a regular guest here on the show. Seth Shostak from SETI. All the websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasore, Timothy Banal, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burles, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.